system's going to collapse first, or the climate will collapse first, or it seems to all be collapsing simultaneously. But his point is, again, that in order to actually make the transition happen, we have to use the existing capitalist, well, he doesn't say this explicitly, but the if we don't do it, if we don't use the remaining oil to produce enough renewables to make the transition happen, the fossil fuel system is just going to continue to cannibalize itself because of the difficulty of getting the last oil and gas out of the ground. So just want to have people check that article out and talk about it. And yeah, I guess we're out of time. Thank you, Patrick. Been really good talking with you.
You too. You too, Paul. Thank you.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows and reaper drones of those who make outrageous fortunes from the suicide bomb of fossil fuel.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogering and Fight the Empire. Newport, Rhode Island has long been a summer home and playground for the very rich, for the people in their employ. It's a year-round home and workplace. My uncle Ole Danielson was the skipper of a racing yacht. A rich guy owned the yacht, and Uncle Ole sailed it on races to Bermuda. He later died in a fire, and his widow Ruth married a man who made large tents and canopies for rich folks' garden parties. And Ruth herself was the caretaker of several mansions when their owners were away, which was most of the time. I remember one time when she took me and my wife into one of the empty mansions to have a look around. Huge dark rooms, furniture covered in white sheets, a lot of unused space. Most of the mansions were on the coast or on Bellevue Avenue, a wide thoroughfare leading to the shore from downtown Newport. Bellevue Avenue had many well-known residents, and perhaps the most famous was Timothy Sullivan. But he was not a rich guy. He was a junk dealer, best known as Timmy the Woodhooker. Now, Timmy and his sister Julia lived in a modest, rundown house that once was part of a neighboring estate. It was said that Julia never left the house, but Timmy had his junk business to maintain. Every day he pushed his wheelbarrow ahead of the town's trash haulers and helped himself to items left on the curb by residents. Then he took the treasures back to his house and put them on display in his overgrown yard. Timmy had lots of customers. My cousin, who lived nearby, used to see cars from all over the USA parked in front of Timmy's house. But Timmy also had his enemies. One was Mrs. Peyton Van Rensselaer, who tried for many years to get his business shut down. She circulated a petition, but could only get 15 neighbors to sign. Among those who refused to sign was Mrs. Cornelius Vanderbilt. One year, a fire broke out at Timmy's house. A Swedish lady who lived nearby called the fire department, and they put out the flames. Mrs. Van Rensselaer was furious. She never spoke to the Swedish lady again. According to my aunt, one year, Timmy the woodhucker took the state civil service exam. He came out third highest in the state of Rhode Island and was offered a plum job, but he turned it down. He said he only took the test to dispel rumors that he was not very bright. Another time, in response to a lawsuit by Mrs. Van Rensselaer, the judge ordered Timmy to bring in his income tax returns from the previous year. It turned out he'd made $50,000, which was big money in those days. One sunny day, I went to Timmy's place. I stood in the overgrown yard admiring the treasures when Timmy himself came out of the house. He had a dog with him, and every time the dog growled, Timmy would swat it with a rolled-up newspaper. We chatted a while and asked about a large ceramic crock that had the number 6 printed on it, a good crock for making home brew. He said it came from England's King George VI and was quite valuable. Eventually, Timmy the woodhucker and his sister Julia passed away. Their house was sold and torn down, but their memory lives on. The number to people want to call in with a question or a comment, the number to call is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Well, the Dow Jones average has hit a record high. Apparently it broke 36,000 the other day, which is great for investors, but less so for everybody else. And it hides some real, perhaps fatal problems. I'm glad that apparently on Paul Rowland's show previous to this, he talked about an article by Nafees Ahmed on the oil system collapsing so fast that it may derail renewables. So I was going to read part of that article because it's it's really worthwhile considering. But if people want to call in with questions or comments, 503-231-8187. This is from the article by Nafees Ahmed. A team of French government energy scientists are warning that the collapse of the global oil system is coming so rapidly it could derail the transition to a renewable energy system if it doesn't happen fast enough. In just 13 years, global oil production could enter into a terminal and an exponential decline, accompanied by the overall collapse of the global oil and gas industries over the next 3 decades. But this is not because the Earth is running out of oil and gas. Rather, it's because they are increasingly eating themselves to stay alive. The oil and gas industries are consuming exponentially more and more energy just to keep extracting oil and gas. That's why they've entered a downward spiral of increasing costs of production, diminishing profits, rising debts, and irreversible economic decline. The implication is that global energy shortages and price spikes will be a taste of things to come if we stay dependent on fossil fuels. Yet a growing narrative has instead wrongly pinpointed the clean energy transition as a culprit. The Economist, for instance, describes gas price spikes as, quote, the first big energy shock of the green era, blaming inadequate investment in renewables and some transition fuels. This could lead to a popular revolt against climate policies. This implies that the fundamental driver of global energy volatility is a transition away from fossil fuels, but this flawed narrative has it exactly backwards. The key to understanding all this is in how the new study published in Elsevier's Applied Energy Journal applies the concept of energy return on investment, otherwise known as EROI. Pioneered by systems ecologist Professor Charles Hall, EROI measures how much energy you must use to extract energy from a given resource of technology. The metric works as a simple ratio that estimates the quantity of energy you can get out from every single unit of energy that's put in. So obviously, the higher the ratio, the better, because it means you can get more bang for your buck. The new study is authored by three French government scientists, along their research found that 15.5%, more than a tenth of the energy produced from oil worldwide is already necessary to keep producing the oil. Yet this is getting worse, not better, since the production of the easiest to get conventional oil slowed down and plateaued around 15 years ago. So we're relying on forms of difficult to extract unconventional oil that uses greater amounts of energy for more complex techniques like fracking. And so this article had shows a downward spiral where in 1950, the EROI of global oil production was really high, about 44%, meaning for every unit of energy we put in, we were getting back a whopping 44% out. Yet as the graphic shows, that this value has undergone a shockingly steep decline. By 2020, it reached around 8 and is projected to decline and plateau around 6.7 from 2040 onwards. And so you see this very steep downward curve here. By 2024, within the next 4 years, the amount of energy we are using for global oil production is going to increase to 25% of energy production. In other words, the world will be using a quarter of the energy produced from oil just to keep producing that oil. Well, it seems that pretty clear that this is a system that is having more and more trouble every year just maintaining itself. And you have to wonder if the industrial age is perhaps coming to a fairly abrupt end. The industrial age only began about 250 years ago, based on energy first from. Thank you. Okay, well, this is Per Fabregas. It's very strange. On my phone, I'm calling from home, of course, my own phone went dead, so I was not, all of a sudden I heard a recorded voice from the operator, but apparently I was still on the air. So I'm not sure exactly where we were when my phone went dead. Maybe if anybody out there can let me know, give us a call at 503-231-8187. We started out this show talking about Timmy the Woodhucker, the junk dealer who... Hello?
Yes, Per, you were at the point where we were talking about the decline in oil production, and it was down to 6.7% in 2024.
Okay, we're talking about the decline in oil production, which apparently I didn't hear the whole show, but Paul Rowland was covering this also on his show, where the decline in oil production is taking more and more oil just to get the oil. And this is obviously this is a recipe for what they call degrowth. Well, the degrowth could be planned and made use of, or it could be something that is thrust upon us just because of the collapsing resources that we depend on. So we have to ask ourselves, this industrial age, which began about 250 years ago, which when you think of it in long-term perspectives, was not that long a time in human history. Human history, you say, began about 6,000 years ago. And the industrial age only happened began around 250 years ago, and seems to be coming to an end that may be more sudden than we realize. And so we might have to ask, what kind of an economy can we have when the oil is no longer available? And many of various natural resources, the metals we use, they will be kind of destined to run out sometime in this century. And after that, what do we have? It's you might say this is sort of the climax century of human economic history, where we've reached this point where we are using our available resources at an alarmingly high rate, and when they are no longer available, then we have to switch to some kind of a non-industrial economy, whether we want it or not. And so we might ask what kind of an economy would come after the industrial age has ended. If anybody wants to call with a comment or a question, the number is 503-231-8187. What do you think? Do you think that our industrial age is coming to an end? What kind of an economy do you think we will be living in, say, 20 or 50 years from now, before this climax century is ended? For one thing, it probably would have to be based on resources that are not destined to run out, on renewable resources. I can think of two offhand. One is hemp, which has many, many industrial uses, and the other is bamboo, which is actually used for building in many parts of the world, and it grows very fast and is very strong and pliable. And I don't know, it's hard to envision when we have cities here made of concrete and steel, what a city would look like when the main building sources are bamboo and wood and various renewable resources. But this is the way most of human history and much of the world today exists. So it's hard to. I read someplace not too long ago that actually even concrete, we think of concrete as something that lasts practically forever, but this is not really true. That concrete has a kind of a it has a I'll call it a shelf life, and it eventually crumbles away. It slowly crumbles into dust and becomes it becomes useless, and the steel rusts, and it lasts longer than a lot of things, but it does not last forever.
Harry, so, you have a caller on the line. His name is Joe.
Joe is on the line. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Pear. So here's the thing. There have been many, many futuristic novels about post-oil, and it's kind of like the young people who gather together and they reuse, repurpose everything that is basically decaying around them to make a new life, and that it's pretty much going back to the frontier days.
Okay, well.
Then there are the people who decide to eat each other and kill each other, so they eliminate each other. And the healthy people go, they head for the hills. And that's kind of how I think that there might be that possibility in various parts of the earth when people can no longer drive or achieve exchanges through jobs and money payments, because you know, people have to eat, and they have to have water, and they drink, and you know, that's what happens. People either get together or they don't get together.
Oh, do you think it's happening pretty soon, or?
Well, I believe that there's a possible collapse. Because we're currently an overshoot as far as a lot of economists have written about, as far as the Earth. Mr. Hunsicker, who is a science writer, has recently talked about it. He publishes in many, many newspapers. Countercurrents is one of them. So, you know, loss of biodiversity, loss of insects, loss of birds, loss of mammals. We're going down. How it's going to turn out, nobody knows. But you know, there's a lot of good guesses out there.
Well, what's your guess?
My guess is there will be adaptations. There'll be preppers. And there'll be people who collaborate and help each other and appreciate life every moment. And then there'll be the greedy people who can't cope and will try to take over and be disruptive and violent. So it's pretty much, you know, how societies are divided right now.
Pear, you have another caller. Bruce is on the line.
Okay, well, we had one call which raised some very interesting points, and now we have Bruce on the line. Good morning, Bruce.
Hi, this is for Joe.
Hello?
Hi. I want to just tell Joe something respectfully. We live in a building, and it was the same in our other building. Lots of young people. They don't recycle. If anything, it's the older people that are more, you know, fearful that recycle. From what I'm seeing, the waste is... it's now a learned trait, and especially with now with everything being delivered in packages. I mean, for my money, being the old man that hangs around in the garbage room, kids don't recycle. That's all I got to say. And it's a great show. And respectfully to Joe, great, but that's not what I'm seeing.
Well, you think this seems to me that this this kind of setup cannot last very long. You think we'll get through this century this way or not?
Oh, I have no clue. We're at the point now with the whole peak oil thing. They tried to say that there's, you know, oil is abiotic and it comes back. But I think they're just waiting for the guy on the white horse to come down with a new thing that'll allow us to consume like we've consumed. And, okay, it might happen. Who knows? But my only point is don't idolize the young. I mean, you know, that maybe this is cranky old man radio, but I just don't, I don't see it. I don't, they're walking down the street with their iPhones and looking at themselves, and I mean, wow, I don't know.
Well, that's where reality catches up someday. The iPhones cannot be recharged, and we're kind of left without our regular devices, so I don't know.
Pierre Marcos is next.
Okay, we have Marcos on the line. Good morning, Marcos.
Good morning. The model that's usually presented by environmentalists addressing climate change is segueing with the current middle-class lifestyle, possibly upper-middle-class lifestyle, and assuming that that's normal, and then being able to segue from that to a clean, green future. And the whole idea is basing that all on these new technologies, including solar. There are great many limitations, as anybody that's ever questioned the new technologies and exactly how impactful they are, how much they depend on rare resources, scarce resources. The model I'd like to leave you with, and I'll keep it short, is compare a cast iron skillet to a Teflon-coated aluminum skillet with a nice plastic handle. That's the technological model I want to present you with. Cast iron skillets can be around, if they're taken care of, for a century. Who knows how long? As long as you don't do something damaging to them, they're built to last. And the technology is extremely simple, and they're made out of iron, which is not all that rare a mineral, et cetera, et cetera. A Teflon-coated aluminum cast frying pan is destined for the garbage heap within a very short time. And those are essentially the two directions we can go in. Our society right now is based on technologies that produce things like Teflon-coated aluminum skillets. And as unfashionable as it might be, we need to scale back and simply do less, but do less in a more thoughtful, more conscientious way, and using the resources we have in a way that's not wasteful, that's actually sustainable.
That's it. Are you optimistic about this? You think we can make this new economy last, or are we kind of destined to kind of fall by the wayside?
I'm not hearing the conversation about less is more. I'm not hearing that. I'm not hearing anything about how we essentially have to downscale our personal footprints, that simply we have to live more simply. That's not been fashionable even amongst environmentalists in trying to get a message to the general public. That was seen as something of as somehow unattractive, unappealing, and not a good sell. Because people have been led to believe that the current lifestyle, the current very high impactful lifestyle that most people aspire to, is the standard. And so it's very unsexy to say, no, actually we can't afford that. We have to do less. We have to do more with less. That's been a tough sell. And it's not even really the conversation. I'm not hearing that conversation. I'm not hearing the Bill McKibbins and the 350.orgs and the organizations that seem to have the largest platform in reaching the public aren't pushing that message.